non-conceptual structures that we are creating while learning in morning. Do you think that the yeshiva does stress that a little bit? Is there a lacking of that? Do you think that there's a lacking in any way in the yeshiva, and that we don't stress the question enough?
I answer the question. I'm not sure when I read the article, so it's a bit difficult. If you haven't, you should, of course. Okay, I'll try to look. I think the basic point before you begin to speculate and why something, you have to know what you're talking about, and it's a point I stressed in the article there. So the first thing to do in learning is simply to take the sugya and try to figure out what's it trying to say. Now, one of the ways to do that is to verify whether the svara actually conforms to the facts or not. Put it differently, to look for nafka minot, to posit a svara and see how does this explain the various machlokot, or does it not, or to do the reverse, take the machlokot and try to understand what's the dividing principle, why does Rav say one thing and Shmuel says something else, or in the time of the Rambam, etc. So the first essential stage is simply arriving at the facts. Now, you could do it the brisk way, you could do it a different way. And personally, I think the brisk way in that regard has been very successful. But first, you come and try to explain the facts through different shittot as well. But stage one, before you begin to speculate why the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants something, is to simply come and see how you understand the sugya. Do you have a theory or an explanation which could simply explain the data which you have in hand in the sugya? And the data could be the machlokot, could be nafkaminot, could be the arguments. Can you explain? Do you explain the ping pong or the shaklavataria better or worse? Once you've done that, and you've arrived at certain, it's facts, you've gathered certain information, I do believe the next stage is trying to figure out where is this leading to. For example, now the one person's why is the other person's what, and vice versa. In other words, it's a good deal, it's in the eyes of the beholder. Do you think we've done enough, or should we take it to the next step? For instance, we're talking in Gittin a lot, at least I've been talking to Ashir a lot, about personal relationships. Do you view the get, is the get an attempt to somehow change a personal status? Is it attempting to, you have here some kind of connection which may be religious, and you have to somehow attempt to deal with that? Or do you see marriage as an interpersonal relationship, and you have to unravel the relationship? Is it get a legal document? Is it a formality? Is it a relationship which you're trying to somehow? Is it basically a relationship crumbling, and you get this expression of the relationship disappearing? Now, you call that the what? You call that the why? In other words, the way I see it, at least, is the common symbol is machloket, and one of prospective machloket claims that this is a more expression of a personal message, and the other one explains it as a formal document. You could say, you call it the what, I call it the why. I think at the end of the day, I think in the one hand, it's the what, it was what you have here, a personal message, or you have a formal document. But if I tell you that I have a personal message here, so why is that so? It's because essentially we view what's going on in marriage as interpersonal relationships. While if you talk about a formal document, so I can talk about other perspectives upon marriage. So I think that the two often, like one plays into the other. Or if you give another example, you can talk about the difference between Melach and Chol HaMoed, between two different approaches. Is Melach and Chol HaMoed same definition of the Lamatet Melachos that you have in Hichol Shabbos, etc.? Or is it simply not going to work? And you can clearly see in Rishonim that both approaches exist. That's what? What is this Melach and Chol HaMoed? Is it an Isur to work? Is it an Isur which is analogous to Melach and Yom Tov and Shabbos and Yom Tov? Now, having said that, I can ask myself, what is it, where is this, what's the next, why is this so? Why should it be a form of, why should it be an Isra Malach like Lamed Tet? Why should it be a Malach of doing Tirch and the like? Now obviously I can tell you why this should be so is because what's my perspective on Chol HaMoed? Is it simply a day of rest? No, it's metaphysical Kedusha is not so great, but it's a day of rest, etc. Well, metaphysically, Chol HaMoed is very much like Yom Tov. Now, so this is why, but having, now this why now becomes a what? In other words, having said that Chol HaMoed is, this Isra Malacha reflects a certain kind of day, well, they could say, well, why is this so? Why is Kadosh Baruch Hu want Chol HaMoed to be more metaphysical and more sanctified? Why does it want to be more day of rest? Does this go back to Yitzias Mitzrayim and the way Yitzias Mitzrayim happened historically or not? In other words, every why will become eventually a what, because it will then be express itself through once you accept that it's a valid presentation or it's a valid claim. So then you can translate that into Nafka Mir, into Machlokot, and then you ask him, why is that so? So you can always go, I think you can always regress backwards and go to a deeper and more basic level. So, in the yeshiva, I think, you know, different Ramim do it differently, and each one has his own, personal, position on the spectrum, how more formal, less formal they want to be. I try, and at least I hope in my show I'm trying to live up to what I wrote in the article. I hope I'm being, I don't think it's like this. That's what I think is desirable. I don't claim that I can always live up to it. But you know, the Shifa, I'll try to ask myself, why should this be so? Now, where you stop, where you feel comfortable, what's your comfort level of stopping? I say maybe individual to each Rama. And I hope that, at least what I wrote, at least I personally trying to live up to what I wrote. I can't, that's for you to judge. But I think I do think you should have a different different approaches and different ramim, and some of them probably will probably tell you this is not the whole right way to go bichlal. It's either be more formal or go in different directions totally. Each ramim reflects his own approach. I just thought to add one final point though. I do believe that a person can make a valid claim for the way the Brishkas do it. In other words, just to focus upon what Kadosh Baruch Hu to do, it can be explained that there's a valid metaphysic behind it. If you come and say mitzvot are done because Kadosh Baruch Hu told you to do them, and why is none of your business, and similarly a child listens to his parent because the parent tells him to do things, because Baruch Hu, like the Gemara says, Lama Tokim, because the Torah says to blow shofar. In other words, and when the Gemara asks Lama Tokim, it doesn't say because Kiyas Shofar is Tshuva or Tefillah or Malchus. It simply says what Lama Tokim, because Baruch Hu said you have to blow Shofar. So it's a valid approach. I personally think it's that we do mitzvah for more than one reason. We do mitzvah A, because we're told to, B, because they also have value and the like. And I think Torah itself gives a dual perspective, but there is a perspective Yirah. That you do things as you're told to, and your only task is to figure out what you're told to do. So, I don't think the Brishkas are doing something which is simply, which lacks the philosophical grounding. Personally, I just think we should try to do, our philosophy should encompass more than one approach. But if they chose that approach, I think it's valid. Your question already assumes the answer, right? It's not true, so we shouldn't take it literally. It's like this: there've been two approaches, throughout through Rishonim. It's I assume that's not a big surprise. The Rambam quotes the Gemara Pesachim to deal with this issue. The Gemara Pesachim describes two theories about how the earth revolves about how the sun revolves around the earth, one is, broadly speaking, one theory is like this. It simply makes a full circle every night. The other one, for reasons which is not too clear to me, Chachmei Yisrael, the way they want to describe it like this, that the sun rises, makes a semicircle around the earth, then loops out a window, and this, and then above the visible sky, above the atmosphere, it then makes a semicircle backwards. And it goes like this, and then the Gemara says there, Chacham Yisrael Umim Kime'ein Teiva, if I remember. Chacham Yisrael, Chacham Umos Olam say this way, V'nirim Divrehem Midvareinu Teida Shema'ayanot Chamot Balayla V'karot Bayom. In other words, the Gemara is like this. This is what Chacham Yisrael, this is what Chacham Umos say, and we, and their opinion seems to be more convincing, and there's empirical proof. The empirical proof is that springs are warmer in the evening than in the morning, apparently because the sun has less time to heat them, whatever. Now, the Rambam took this Gemara as a paradigm and they approached the whole question. In his opinion, so it means that scientific questions, you just follow the best opinion. In other words, there's no, to put it differently, why is it so? There's no revelation involved in his opinion. It's rather, it's a human attempt to understand what's going on. And since, essentially, it's human reason trying to fathom what's going on in nature, so Goy and a Jew basically are on equal footing. Had there been revelation, so when the Rambam talks about, for instance, the question of creation, it's a whole different story. Because there you have revelation. When he's talking about simply trying to figure out what's going on in the world, so he says, so if it's Torah, that's a different story. It has to do with Masorah, it has to do with the relationship, but not Torah, but science. That's simply human beings trying to figure out what's going on. Because Baruch Hu didn't tell us, didn't reveal us these secrets. I mean, Mele, you their opinion is just as good as ours. And now in this case, so the Gemara tries to seek some kind of empirical proof or support, and it thinks that in this case their opinion is more convincing. Therefore the Rambam says anything on scientific questions you follow going as well as Jews. Of course, what's ironic here is that nowadays we think neither. The Rambam would say beside that, if nowadays Copernicus gave us a different theory, also, just as good. It would be he references the Shiv Kubetz in Ksuvas. Shiv Kubetz there says that that you follow that it's only Nir'im Divrehem Midvareinu. Be'emet, the truth is like us. It's only Nir'im. It's so to speak, it's a misconception. It seems to like that, but it's not so. And if we say in Shabbat, it's Vokeach Alonei Rakia. That's the window that loops outside. It's the Shiv Kubetz quotes the name of Ben Tam, if I remember. Such approaches exist. The bigger problem now, but broadly speaking, I think the Rambam's position is a valid position. Now, let me add something else. The Ramban writes in his introduction to the Torah that he believes Torah has embedded within it all natural science. But it's embedded in a way that only a person with Kabbalah and a Masoret can somehow find the clues and... if something goes to revelation, it's a whole different story. But the thing is, Ramban doesn't think that we know that either. In other words, in his opinion, a person who has this Masoret and knows all the Sod, so he'll probably have correct scientific knowledge. And if his knowledge will contradict what we think, we should follow his knowledge. But since we don't have that, in other words, 99.99% of people don't have Masoret, and it's only for singular individuals, so maybe we're trying to use our reason to figure things out. I would also add something else. The whole question of can you follow goyim and not science and not in lavdafka, all kinds of traditions, is perked by certain assumptions. Assumptions that goyim and Jews are one and the same as human beings. Right, for instance, in medicine, we take that for granted. Right, you assume that research done on kidneys in the United States is valid in Israel also. That you have to do a new trial because maybe Jews have different kidneys than goyim. You assume, unless you know scientifically that there are genetic differences, you assume that's the same. So as long as you're talking about phenomena which you assume are the same, and we assume that their reason is the same, it works. the moment it's not the same, so then you have to stop. Now, it could be not the same because the phenomena are different. And here you have to ask yourself, where do you see the difference? Nowadays, most people say, not in physical sciences, but maybe in social or sciences or humanities. It could be different because of your philosophical approach. In other words, scientists don't work in a vacuum. Scientists have their own agendas and their own worldviews as well. When you come to deal with various observations and empirical evidence is based upon what metaphysics you start from. In other words, what you consider as a valid explanation is essentially metaphysics at the end of the day. I'll give you an example. If I tell you that tzaddik, that a mekubal, a tzaddik, is so dilemma, etc., he traveled from Yerushalayim to Tel Aviv where his gas meter was in zero. So if you accept, that they're moifsim, and that you accept because Rachel will do a nes for individual just to solve his problem to get from here to there, so that's a valid explanation. If you think, because Rahu doesn't upstage nature frequently, and if you take the Rambam's approach, so you have to assume that really he was in high empty, not in low empty, and there's some gas left, even though it's a zero, there's really some gas left in the tank anyways. In other words, your explanation is a function of your metaphysics. So you always have to ask yourself, for instance, if you talk about psychology, do you have a deterministic approach or approach which accepts b'chach of she? So those kind of things you have to you view history. Do you view providence in history? You see Ashkacha work through history or not? Same goes biblical criticism. Do you accept revelation? So you can't accept those conclusions. In other words, the moment if all the things are equal, so then you can accept their conclusions. We assume in science all things are equal. We don't necessarily assume that where the metaphysical assumptions differ. So that's why it's not so self-evident. The things which we think are the same, so yes, and I think in the Gadol we tend to accept that.
Could our
Moshe
tell us how we should relate to drinking or
swearing? To what?
Drinking or swearing.
We do that. So we do that in a separate session. I know before or after, but we'll do that. I'll start from this, from the end. We should to make it so to be serious and be intense and be committed. Why now to announce? I think I spoke about this in the past, but I'll summarize in two words. Essentially, Christianity, modern Orthodox, one of two reasons. If you're a modern Orthodox, it can be a philosophical movement, it can be a historical movement. But a person can be modern Orthodox because he says to himself, basically says like this, I'm modern, that's a given. Because my lifestyle is such, I don't want to give it up. I don't want to live in Bnei Brak. I want to be able to tap into various amenities or conveniences of modern life. It's because my worldview is such, that's my philosophy is modern. As a person who essentially said to himself, it's a given that I'm modern, and his Rav can say to himself, it's my Balabati, I'm modern, that's a given. The question now is, they're going to go to the movies anyways. Must we go to the movies with a kippah and with a plain tefillah in the morning, then not. That if you come in composites, either or, so you're not sure that the daf could choose what you want them to choose. And that to a large degree is what modern Orthodoxy was historically. Meaning, various figures did not always necessarily subscribe to the philosophy. They said to themselves, this is where the tzibur is. The tzibur at the moment is going to be modern whether we like it or not. What do we have to do now? We have to make sure they remain Orthodox as well. Now, if you are the leader of the community, that's maybe a valid cheshbon. And therefore, there are many people who are willing to be rabbanim and the chanachim, whatever, modern communities, Take many Haredi educators in modern Orthodox schools. What do they say to themselves? They say to themselves, the kids are modern, that's a given. If I can make them non-modern, maybe that'll be better, but I can't. That's a given. So my son will be modern, study Gemara, and put on children, and et cetera, et cetera, rather than to be modern not do all of that. So, now of course, but from the perspective of the person, it's a very poor and weak and diluted form of modern Orthodoxy. Essentially prioritizing your lifestyle or your secular beliefs over your religious commitment. Conversely, a person can be modern Orthodox because he believes, you know, if you want, the way the Rav tried to lead the community. Meaning, you do it because you believe it has the best power for you, that it that your life spiritually will be richer by being able to tap into certain into certain accomplishments and achievements of modern culture, and you have to be careful what you take. You have to filter what you believe is proper and correct. In other words, you have to be sure that you get from modernity what Chazal say, "Kama tukanim shabahem, v'lo kama kulkalim shabahem." But if you do that, so it can enhance your spiritual life. Now, if you do that, you're in constant tension. It's a tension both because some modern values are antithetical to Yiddishkeit, and you have to be careful, constantly on guard that you are not seeping into your shkafa. Additionally, there's also a question of allocating resources. If I'm talking now not about a modern lifestyle, I'm talking about a modern philosophy. So how much time do you spend studying literature and philosophy? How much time do you spend studying Zvachim and Menachos? At the end of the day, they're 24 hours a day, and you have to sleep, eat, etc., etc. So you can't do everything. So if you're going to be studying, if you're going to be reading Shakespeare, you're not going to be studying Zvachim at that moment. So there's constant tension. How do you divide your time? How do you divide your resources and your attention? If you're doing so, I believe you can enhance your... is it viable? Yes, it's viable if you're to be committed and to enhance your observance, your religious experience. Just to give an example, I think if you look at Tanakh, at the moment, you know, in modern Orthodoxy, in Israel, it's certainly more vibrant and more sophisticated than Tanakh... in communities which are Orthodox, but not modern Orthodoxy, because the tools that literature and history and the like and historical awareness and the literary appreciation provide for the Sunni Tanakh are more sophisticated than if you lack those tools. And if a person if a person reads Kierkegaard about the Akedah. So on the one hand, there are all kinds of Christian motifs there, and the person has difficulty sifting them out or filtering them out. So he may have a certain residue of a Christian. I'm not saying it's not something around this particular example, but it's there. In other words, you end up with a certain residue of Christian values there. On the other hand, though, if you're able to filter it out or to take the basic point and then apply like what the Gemara says, don mina vuki batra, take the idea and then position it in your within your tradition, it's a very powerful and forceful and impressive reading of the Akedah. You can then agree with it or disagree with it, but it challenges you to think about the Akedah and to and the like. So therefore, but this requires to be committed to live the tension and to be personally learning. It's modern Orthodox would only be about diluting the product because we're so busy doing literature, theater, sports, and the like, and we have no time left for Dalamas of Halacha. So it'll be a diluted product, and the conclusion will be it's not a viable model, and therefore people will move, people will leave, those who are serious will leave modern Orthodoxy, and at the end of the day, seriousness will win out. And so therefore, for it to be viable, it has to be intense, committed, serious, and the like. I would add one final point. If you're talking about modern Orthodoxy, it's a historical movement, not the one that's a philosophy to choose. To appreciate, one, you have, you have to recognize that for such an appreciation, whether it's viable or not, and whether it's the right choice or the wrong choice, you need a broader perspective. Meaning, at the moment, it seems, you know, at least in the Chutzlar, it seems to be on the defensive, and it seems to be that the Haredi model is more intense, is more widespread. There's a sense of riding the wave and intensity, and you know, Baruch Hashem, that they're the thing though is that the danger with such approach is, in a sense, modern Orthodoxy, what does it do in a sense? Modern Orthodoxy comes and says, I'll expose you to secular values, philosophy, ideas, and I will then, so for either I'll integrate, in the best case scenario, I'll integrate them and be able to take the best of them to my own, but at the very least, I'll also provide you with answers how to cope with various questions and doubts that arise. To a large degree, at least historically, the Haredi approach has been, don't ask the questions. You have to know the answers because you have to ask the questions. Now, that works. So if you're in a society which isn't asking the questions, and to a large degree, that's to a large degree what's going on nowadays, the last 30, 40 years, Benayeta, because there was a sense that, used to quote a thing from the Panavish Iran. He used to say, nowadays, what's the big deal to be from? There's nothing to entice you not to be. When I was young, there was Tolstoy, there was communism, there was socialism. In other words, there was a sense of a wave of... what he's really saying, that's not so much Tolstoy is profound or not. The real point is that there's a sense that secular life is full of values. Values you may disagree with, but there's a sense of people living a life inspired by values, and they ought to change the world. In other words, the socialists, the communists, all those chevre were trying to really tikkun l'taken olam, b'malchut ha-communism, whatever, but they were trying to taken olam. And now you had to, now it's time, the last 3-4 years, it's been much less like that. The sense has been of every man for himself and the sexual revolution and all that. So there's very little to offer, so you know, it's much easier to present people with a world that just says, let's turn our backs on the world. But point is, if one day people ask various questions, either because the secular world will once more change, or because various doubts, in other words, I think the starting point has to be, because Baruch Hu created the world with B'chira Chofshit. Now, B'chira Chofshit means that you, it's deep, it doesn't only mean that you can do something good or bad. It means you can observe the world and you can see within a deeply religious picture, and you can see a secular picture. The fact that there are scientists who are Orthodox and Christian and the like, and there are scientists who are atheists and agnostics and so on, what does it proves one thing. It proves, just by looking at the nature alone, you don't have the answer. So that you'll need additional equipment, meaning masoret, meaning what you feel inside your soul, and the like. Because observing nature alone can lead you to, because you take people who observe nature constantly, they're paid to do that, eventually, and they arrive at different conclusions. So apparently nature itself is more neutral, and now because it, and this is true, this goes for many other areas as well. I mean, by the way, if you take, for instance, take the Rav and compare it to Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish begins, "When I'll be Dachon, why should a person believe?" So it gives you this long passage in which he talks about, you look at nature and you preach a Kadosh Baruch Hu, you see his wisdom and you immediately believe. It's quote unquote a cosmological proof, it's this wonderful passage in terms of the poetry within it, but it essentially assumes, basically disregards all of 19th and 20th century science and philosophy. And now it's so if you're unaware of that, it works, but if you're aware of philosophy, science, and etc., what's happened in the last 20 years, So it's very difficult to be convinced by that. You read the Rav writes like this. The Rav writes that me and often ha'adam mishtageh v'kofer, this guy, he turns back into the Baruch Hu. Biram, however, ha'metziut atzma ashema b'mvuchazo. That's a quote. In other words, reality itself, or nature itself, is to blame for part of this dilemma. And the reason is because nature doesn't give a straightforward message. The idea which the Rambam and the Havdil, Christians up to the 17th century believed in, you could prove the rest of it, it's not going to happen. And Chazunish is in big trouble. Why is most of the world secular if he believes you can prove it? So he gives answers. But so now, if you're asking, is Mark actually Bible? It seems like this. When no one's asking questions, so you don't need it to keep people free. You only need it because if you want to enhance your understanding. So Sefer Chinuch has a very interesting thing. The Rambam defines the mitzvah of Emunah, Leida Sheyesha Matsui Rishon. You have to know that God exists. And many people understand the Rambam, that it means you have to actually know the proofs. Now, the Sefer Chinuch is bothered by that. It's not exactly a prescription for the masses. So he writes like this: I have to believe because Rahu exists, but it's a hidur mitzvah to know the philosophy behind it. So I'm saying, so as long as along these lines, as long as no one's asking questions, you don't need to be modern Orthodox. However, I do believe it can enhance you, it can give you a deeper experience and the like. But you have Gurus because Rahu without that. But the point is, if at some point in the future, as in the past, people will ask questions, so modern Orthodox equips people with the ability to answer them. Now, because the questions, the answers are not clear, not 100% foolproof, so there will always be a certain amount of attrition. Now, modern Orthodox, almost by definition, has a certain amount of attrition built into it. Not, it doesn't have to be like that, but Lamaise, there is a certain, and it may very well be that at the moment it's a higher level than the corresponding Haredi group. But the point is that if and when questions will be asked, modern Orthodox will remain the same level. And what will happen in the Haredi world will be Chas v'Shalom, a disaster, because no answers. And that's what happened in Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe in the 19th century, they basically circled the wagons, and they put up high walls trying to prevent questions from being asked. Up to late 19th century, it worked. In other words, more or less, most people were firm. But another question, up to late 19th century, there were a few masculine. But however, at some point, when the dike broke and the flood began, there were no answers. In other words, the level of secularism between the wars in Eastern Europe was much worse than in Germany. Germany had its constant situation, but what New Orthodoxy built up, from Hirsch downwards, was the ability to cope with science. Science, and I mean historical science as well. And therefore, it made more constant. While in Eastern Europe, originally it was better. At the end, it was much worse. When we talk to talk here about Reiti Olam, it's a mention about Noach. Noach says, Reiti Olam Banui, Olam Charev, Olam Banui. So we tell you to say, and if you talk to anyone who's honest about Eastern Europe, he'll tell you the same thing. Reiti Olam Banui, Eastern Europe before the war. Reiti Olam Charev, not the Shoah. Reiti Olam Charev, spiritually before the war. That the years before the Shoah, it was charev spiritually because of secularism. And then with Yolam Banoi, that's what post Shoah. So I think you need modern Orthodox notes. Simply put, if I'll just summarize this whole thing in metaphor, I think the moment in the Haredi world is like someone who's invested all his money in the market. Obviously, when the market goes up, you're doing much better off than if you spread your investments, if you diversify into bonds and all kinds of other more mundane investments. But if the market goes down, you crash if all your eggs are in the same basket. And so at the moment, I think it's yes. Modern Orthodoxy can give you a more viable and, excuse me, can give you a deeper and I think a deeper experience, but the other model is viable as well. My great concern is that if the spiritual atmosphere will change and questions we can ask, so that the non-modern Orthodox model, then the shock absorbers. It's very scary. And so at the moment, that's what I think on a broader perspective, the question really is often reversed. The only reason that Lakewood and Benoteha have so many people now is the parents of the people who went to Lakewood in the 80s, during the 50s, were modern Orthodox. Because in the 50s, it was very difficult to be Haredi, besides for small groups. The vast majority, modern Orthodoxy would save the vast majority of American Jewry, and also not, I think it's the same is true of the Commonwealth also. The vast majority of the people who remained from in those years were modern Orthodox, because that was a period in which questions were being asked. Eventually, the pendulum swung the other way, and there's a beside there. But you have to be careful. If you swing again, you have to have in place your safeguards.
I might be wrong about this, but I feel like informing people that in the Dati Lumi education today, there is a high amount of Hasidic teachings that the Hasidic taught in the schools. Do you think, is it true, or are you making it up, and if it's true, do you see it as a good thing, a bad thing, neutral? Dangerous.
Okay, is it true? I don't know if it's true about this, about the curriculum per se. It's certainly true about the approach and the mindset. It's certainly true about a good deal of the spiritual atmosphere pervading the family schools. And but they're translated into curriculum, I don't know. That's like this one. Say Chumash, I still assume they say Ramban and Ibn Ezra, and not, Tolos Yaakov Yosef or things like that. But because essentially it's not always institutionalized Hasidus also. It's not necessarily the Hasidus of the past 200 years. It's often what they call New Hasidus or Kalibach or whatever, or Bratstav, from Chabakuk in a code word. So, it certainly is very predominant. Look, you go to, it's not only in the high schools, it's the whole, go to shuls here. So you see how much dancing goes on in the shuls. Go to funerals, which you can hear singing in funerals. I've been in the past 5 years to a few funerals. People died tragic. I'm not talking about people who died, 100 years old. I'm talking about people who died of cancer, and they left in their wills that they should sing song X, Y, Z at their funerals. And so I think the observation is certainly true. Of course, don't forget, here Yachasit, the self-selected process of people apply to us, is somewhat not representative. Go to some other places and you'll see much more extreme examples of this. But even in Yeshiva, and we tell like to take pride that we built a bit midrash with windows, so. With windows, you don't see what's going on outside the way you used to talk, but you also see, in other words, winds from the outside blow inside as well. Is it good or bad? Let me say the following. I'll begin from history. Okay, that'll allow me to sidestep the question for the next 2 minutes. But it's important to understand us, I think. In a sense, I think we believe in a dialectic. Now that means that you want to allow that you believe different energies, different spiritual energies, different kochot hanefesh are important as Hashem, right? Let Hashem kecha b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol meodecha. You didn't say only b'chol levavcha. By the way, the most Yishonim levavcha means with your knowledge, nafshecha is with your heart. Look at Ramban over there. But we want to combine both emotion and knowledge, both the intellect and the more emotional side of life. Additionally, the emotional elements of life, they're more than one element, and we want to express a variety of them. Now, to go back to the previous question, I'll skip a stage and then go back to Vital said it a few years ago, and I think it's a very correct observation. Part of this Chassidut is a reaction to a sense that religious life in the previous generation was much too rational and much too intellectual. Now, this is for two reasons. One was because the dominant educational force was the yeshivot, the liturgy yeshivot, and they emphasized to a large degree, in the question of Torah versus Tefillah, do you prioritize Torah, do you prioritize Tefillah, do you prioritize intellectual achievement over emotional expression, yeshivot were to a large degree emphasized the intellect. It wasn't nothing was going on with the yeshivot. There was a lot of sociology and social content going on in yeshivot as well. But, the banner they held, at least, and to a certain degree, it's true, because most of the day you spend in social activity, and more often than not, prestige and the like, we went to that. So, and yeshivot, on the one hand, emphasized more the limud. There's also something else. Because, what I said before, because of the sense that orthodoxy was in the retreat, on the defensive, and orthodoxy is archaic and old-fashioned and anachronistic. So there's a conscious decision, concerted effort, maybe is a better way to say it, to make it seem much more modern. And by modern meaning, to be much more rational. Don't forget that if you want tradition, has within it an X amount of mitzvot and I can explain to you many halachot. Maybe also simply like minhag. I'll give you an example. When I was a child, it was the shtibach. There was a shul in Katamon, Karlin. Karlin was in the third floor of a, you had to go up a dank, three flights of steps. The odor was not too ayayay in them. And you come to this room, but the lighting was. I don't remember if it was candles or bulbs. That's how bad the lighting was. And with posters, from 30, 40 years ago, which are appealing. Nowadays, the place like Katamon, people would say how romantic, how nostalgic, how authentic. At the time, it gave out one man, and the people there, some of the old timers didn't spoke only Yiddish. It was like stepping back in Eastern Europe. Mamash. Nowadays we say, wow, wonderful. Then, what did it say then? Old-fashioned. Old-fashioned, annoying, out of connection with with the times, and the like. It turned people off. And the same was true of many such similar phenomena. So the idea was to upgrade these things, make them much more modern. I'll give you two examples. Take the Sidur, Vinat Yisrael. Vinat Yisrael became the state of Sidur. What's the idea of Vinat Yisrael? It's austere. It's there's so much taken out of it. The classic Sidur has Slichas and Kriyas HaTorah for Tanis Esther and a thousand one things that really don't always belong, or at least use them once a year, whatever. All kinds of Mishnayos to say Shabbos afternoon. All of this was taken out. Now Israel, look how much margin there is to text. Instead of being thick, a huge amount of text with small margins, which basically said poverty and being all and one. Vinat Yisrael was going to be very light. The idea was to make it not seem dark, but make it seem light and make it seem user-friendly and rational, and explain the difficult words, but in other words, no perushim there, which are Kabbalah Hasidut. It's all explain to you what the word means, and it took out so much. It took out the shlichos, they took out Tilim and a bunch of other stuff. The idea was to modernize the Siddur. Or take Torat Chaim. Take Dat Mikra. Dat Mikra was trying to integrate modern scholarship into a Persian and Tanakh. Because, we're out of touch with modern times. Take Torat Chaim even. What's the idea of Torat Chaim? Or what do they do? Torat Chaim did something very simple. they threw out all of the mystical perushim and replaced them with rationalism from medieval Spain. In other words, they took out, to put it differently, they took out the Archaim and the Kli Yakar and the Datsukim Balei Tosfos, and they replaced them with Radak, with Psadigon, and the like. Now, they're all very important, they're all Choshev Yidden. There's no, but there's a Megama. The Megama is very simple. The Megama is to be more rational and to be less into mysticism and the like. And all this was done because modernity, Orthodoxy felt that it was on the defensive and had to be more modern to justify itself. It had to prove that modernity and Orthodoxy didn't contradict. Now, the pendulum has swung. People felt turned off. It was too much intellect. Not enough. It lost its warmth. It lost its warmth. All that was left was reason. But reason alone is not enough. So began a reaction to a more, much more Hasidic, touchy feely, emotional, expressive way. Now, the response itself is legitimate. The question now is, though, do you try to work out some kind of middle ground in which you say, I want both, or do you go to the opposite extreme and you're like, take a place like Beth Ayin. The basic idea there is anti-reason. Doesn't mean love, it's anti-Western culture, anti-Western medicine, anti-Western music, and so on and so forth. Anti-Western building methods. I'm serious. That was when my daughter once went to visit a friend. There was a donkey in the backyard. What's he doing here? It's a kisuch v'zibul. It's a lawnmower. They brought a donkey. I don't think it was a poverty. Donkeys cost more than lawnmowers. It's simply the idea is, and it has to do with technology and the Western world we'll turn our backs upon. So therefore, if you ask me, it depends what you do with it now. Do you integrate the two? Do you channel? Chassidut gave a lot to the world, a lot of positive things. But the question now, do you take and try to integrate and combine and, give on the one hand, do you try to take the emotional elements? Not only Hasidut, I'm saying you can take emotional elements from other areas as well. It doesn't mean only from Hasidut. But you try to make your Avodas Hashem of the intellect, of the heart, and of the mind. Or do you just now? And that I think is a positive idea. In other words, take these energies and channel them into the right place. And there's nothing wrong with expressing emotions and with dancing. And this, however, the moment it becomes that you prioritize this at the expense of the intellect, then we're in trouble. At the end of the day, you have to agree with the Rambam that Tzimokim is Das. You have to accept the fact that a basic element of how a human being experiences the world is through his mind. Our basic way of essentially filtering the world is through our seichel. We divide, we analyze. In other words, any attempt to grasp the world, to experience it as a human being, without using intellect, is a tremendous shortcoming. It gives you a very partial and warped view of the world. You have to approach the world with your intellect as well. And then not only with your intellect, but also with your intellect. And therefore, if Hasidut means basically discounting the intellect and discounting education, and not learning, Gemara Rishonim seriously, then it's a negative development. If it means integrating the two and having a deeper appreciation of your emotions and your feelings, and combine this with your intellect, so it's wonderful. So that's really where. The question is going. Now, Chassidut also has a certain hashkafa. Okay, so that's a question of Eilu v'Eilu. And when we say Eilu v'Eilu, it doesn't mean you have a position. When we say Eilu v'Eilu, it doesn't mean that therefore everything goes. It means I have my position. I believe it's right. It's personally, I subscribe to a certain view. Eilu v'Eilu means I recognize the legitimacy of your different approach. It doesn't mean I have to agree to it. So, in other words, in terms of hashkafa, yes, we should stand up, and the classic formulation of non-Hasidic Yiddishkeit is Nefesh HaChaim. Why was it written? Because of Hasidim. How come no one brought Nefesh HaChaim before that? Because there was no Hasidic challenge to force you to formulate and to write. So there's nothing wrong with being challenged and forced to formulate and reaffirm your beliefs and your opinions. And additionally, there may be some kind of positive influences. And from the Ashkenazi point of view, I don't mind saying Elu ve'Elu, as long as we recognize that Elu doesn't mean that we should give up or forfeit our beliefs. Now, the real problem is, is there excess? Are things taken to an excessive... that's true of both directions. Okay, last question.
Recently, I was on Facebook and I stumbled upon the page for Modern Orthodoxy, and I noticed that the profile picture for Modern Orthodoxy was a picture of you.
I was sorry, but he's here.
Do you mind your answers to the previous few questions? Do you mind responding to this? I don't know if you're aware.
Have the picture. Someone sent me the picture about a year ago. I assume it's somehow after a year will be updated. But okay, I'm glad the picture is still there. No, it's a PR picture. The yeshiva taken about Midrash. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't. I didn't even copy the picture at home even. But the office, the Bnei Chutzatz office used that picture for a few years, and I don't know how it ended up. Whether it's only with some Shemaya or Avonot, you know, maybe Brat Chataim, but. Someone pointed out to me a year ago, and beside it, you know, I want this on the picture. I'm surprised that they haven't changed it yet. Beside it, to that of